You've been chewing gum this whole time?
I've gum almost every time I'm in Hot Takedown. Is this going to go on the top of the show?
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot smaller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, it's the full crew, Neil Statman Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. And the MVP of Hot Takedown and ESPNW columnist, Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad. What does the V stand for in that MVP?
Oh, I was thinking value. Do you have
something
else?
Oh, good, okay. No. Maybe versatile?
Virtuosic.
Ooh. Just wanted to double check that there wasn't some hidden meaning in MVP.
I've been secretly negging you this whole time.
Yeah.
On today's show, folks, it's a one-topic edition of Hot Takedown.
That's pretty rare. Have we ever done that at all?
Well, stat schools, I suppose. But this is not a stat school. This is a debate. Not Lincoln Douglas. This is a free-for-all about who the most valuable player in the National Basketball Association is. We're going to talk about five players, I think, but we're going to talk about that as well. Who comes out on top?
Do you want me to have an open mind about all these candidates, or do you want me to have my MVP candidate and then defend them to the death?
I want you to come. We're going to talk about each candidate in order,
okay,
working our way towards who the consensus candidates are, I think.
Okay.
And then I think you should come ready to change your mind, to have the stat man. Just sort of really, you know, convince you stats playing you into submission.
Okay.
And then, but I would presume that your hypothesis, your sort of beginning thoughts will win out towards the end.
Okay.
I'm not thinking that we're going to.
It almost is like a stat school.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. Let's do it.
So I say my first proposal to the group here is that we talk about five players and no more than five. That we talk about James Harden of the Rockets, Russell Westbrook of the Thunder, Stephen Curry of the Warriors, Kawhi Leonard of the Spurs, and LeBron James of the Cavs. We're not going to talk about Isaiah Thomas.
I'm going to give him a little nod here at the top, though.
Isaiah, we look in your direction. We bend our necks towards you. Because you're so short.
We took a zing at him.
We're not going to talk about Kevin Durant. We're not going to talk about who else? Rudy Gobert.
Chris Paul,
etc. That okay with you guys?
Kyle Lowry.
Yeah?
Yep.
All right. Let's begin with Stephen Curry. Two-time MVP, the defending MVP. Played basically all season long. Sat for a couple games of rest, but nothing beyond that. Has regressed to the mean compared to his otherworldly year. Last year, 25 points per game. 6.6 assists, which is much less than some of the others that we'll talk about later on the show. The 3-point field goals, 41%. That's not his. That's below his career average of 44. So he's down from what he usually is on his career and sort of the hallmarks of his game, that being threes and assists. That being said, what he did last year was essentially unsustainable. It was a season like we'd never seen before. So let's begin with Curry. Neil, do you want to make the statistical case for Curry, perhaps using some of our colleague Ben Morris's analysis that shows basically that the Warriors are a great team that's made even better by Curry?
Sure, yeah. So I think the case for Curry is made in kind of two steps. So the first step is, you know, the Warriors set the all-time record for wins last season, and you know we couldn't stop talking about them as potentially being the greatest team of all time. Well, guess whether or not the metrics like point differential were better for last year's Warriors, 73-win Warriors, or this year's Warriors?
The way you set up the question, this year's Warriors.
Yes. Yeah, very
perceptive. So you're saying this year's Warriors are better than last year's Warriors,
right, despite
the different record.
Yeah, despite the non-record-breaking wins and losses.
The temptation would be to say that's because of Durant,
Yes.
You know, that you add this all-world player, obviously they're going to get better. Is it all Durant, or has Curry been just as integral?
No, it looks like even – I mean, that was my first thought when this kind of debate was broached, even knowing that the Warriors were better this year. It seems logical that, well, yeah, of course, when you add Kevin Durant to the mix, you're going to be a better team and have a better point differential. But it looks like the key to all of that point differential is still Steph Curry. So when Curry is on the court, the Warriors outscore opponents by 17 points per 100 possessions, which, like, for maybe for reference sake, the 96 Bulls were around like 11, 12 points of margin per 100 possessions. So we're talking about, like, they play significantly better than the 96 Bulls, for instance, when Curry is on the court. And when he's not on the court, the Warriors only outscore the other team by 0.2 points per 100 possessions. So the difference between having Curry on the court and not is the difference between someone who's way better than the 96 Bulls and an average NBA team. And that holds up even if you kind of control for who he's playing with and against. He has one of the best real plus-minus ratings of any player in the league, which kind of isolates a player's individual contribution to that plus-minus. So and Durant, for instance, is all the way down. He's 11th in the league. He's like really good, but not one of the top players in this plus minus impact. And I think it still speaks to like Curry is the fulcrum around which that team, you know, operates.
That is compelling evidence, because I think judging by the eye test or the gaze, the narrative, the story around this season has been so much that Curry isn't as good as he was last year. In fact, I think when it comes to the MVP debate, in my mind, Curry is his own worst enemy.
Like, because he was so good last
year. Yeah, how can I support for MVP candidate a guy who I've seen play at a level that seemed 20% higher than I'm currently seeing? So it's a sort of a human reaction to be like, well, I don't want to award MVP to a guy who have seen play better.
Especially given how good some of the other players are. I think,
right.
I'm sure there have been MVP candidates who have regressed from a past MVP,
yes,
a year that they've had. But in this instance, we have basically an incredible crop of performances in this year's NBA.
And I think even though, Neil, you articulated the separation that Curry provides the Warriors on the court, when you look at the numbers, I think it's hard on an instinctual level to understand how Curry separates the Warriors and what that might mean in terms of their position in the standings or their position to compete for an NBA title. All of these things feel unknowable on some level. When you add in the talent of Kevin Durant and all the other talent on that team, it almost feels as if Curry now is like a marginal increase, even though those numbers suggest otherwise.
So our colleague Ben Morris, who's writing about, who's making the case for Curry on 538 this week, we're doing sort of five different case for player X.
And does each one pieces have a separate writer?
Yes, exactly.
So that we don't get bias and
we
good.
Never would do bias at 538. Good. So, you know, Ben points out that we like to think that it's not hard to make a great team even greater, right? That there's sort of with Durant that Curry's job isn't that hard. But that the way that the stats shake out, it suggests that it's harder to make a great team greater than it is to make an okay team good.
And we've talked about this before, like this kind of diminishing returns effect where adding, you know, taking a team that's already really good and then adding some kind of, you know, star to it, and the Warriors are a good example of that with Durant, doesn't necessarily make them, like, you know, it's not simply additive. It there's something lost usually in the translation between, you know, a group of players that are already good. But in this case with Curry, when he's not on the court, the Warriors, despite all their talent, just don't seem to work properly. There's something about him that allows, instead of taking away from teammates when he's added to them, it allows the whole team to actually function more than the sum of its parts. And the sum of those, and the parts are also like incredibly good.
Yeah, and to the first point that Chad made about making something good great, it's not the same as basketball, but I think we all understand, like, oh, I want to get in good enough shape to run an 8-minute mile. That's something very different than saying, I want to run, you know, a 6-minute mile.
Right. Like, if you start at 10 minutes and you try to go to 8, that's a lot easier than going from 8 to 6.
Yeah, you can do that in a couple months. But then to get to 6, I mean, you're talking like maybe
60. But it's just 2 minutes. It's just two more.
So to that point, like, that kind of makes sense on an instinctual level. And to the Curry being the fulcrum of the Warriors, I do wonder how much of that is the very fact that, like, foundationally, when these Warriors started getting good, it was built around Curry, and how much of that is baked into
the system or orbits around him, or as Neil said, different metaphor, he's the fulcrum,
as opposed to if they, for some reason, Curry got hurt and then they brought in another guard like Kyle Lowry all of a sudden. Like, I don't know how that works anymore because the whole system is built around Curry.
So I want to leave it there on Curry, because I essentially want the way we talk about this to be like a survivor pool or a knockout pool, I guess, where I think we'll talk about Kawhi Leonard next, for example.
Okay.
And if we think that Kawhi bests Curry, then we'll move on with Kawhi and leave Curry behind. But we'll do sort of one-to-one comparisons with whoever the survivor is.
I see how this works.
Yeah, you see how this works now? Good.
And I'm open-minded, too. I want you to know. Right now, Curry's the MVP in my mind.
Exactly.
Okay.
But let me complicate that.
First of one.
Okay.
Okay, so let me complicate that clarity that you have right now, and let's bring in Kawhi Leonard, San Antonio Spurs forward, sort of, I guess, a wingman, right? Fair to call him a wingman. The do everything.
Swingman.
Swing. The do everything swingman for the Spurs, averaging 25.7 points this year, far above his average of 16.4. This is really a year in which we're seeing Leonard take the leap that I feel like he's basically been taking for, what, three years in a row now, and it's sort of like a triple jump. He's just getting further and further down that sandy pit.
Really, 4 years.
Okay,
so it's like a quadruple jump. It's not yet an Olympic sport, but he's doing it really well.
his metrics are good on offense, not blow you away. He has a 54.2 effective field goal percentage, which combines the threes and the twos. But the win shares are 13.6, which is very high. The big thing though is defense, where Kawhi Leonard is known to be a great defender. The metrics have been questioning his defense this year. Neil, do you want to talk a little bit about why and whether that should factor in to our conversation around him?
Yeah. So one of the kind of best ways that we can tease out how good someone is on defense, and we've talked about this on Stat School, is looking at those plus-minus stats and trying to figure out, okay, how well does the defense perform while a player's on the court versus off the court, try to account for who they're playing against and try to kind of account for all the different variables that can come into play. And usually that works really well. You know, if you're on the court and the opponent scores fewer points per 100 possessions compared to when you're off the court, you are probably a pretty good defensive player, and vice versa. If they're giving up a lot more points with you on the court, you're probably not doing that good of a job. In the case of Kawhi Leonard, though, it's a very strange thing where he has a great track record in that particular stat up until this year. And this year, when he's on the court, the Spurs are allowing 106.8 points per 100 possessions. League average is probably around 106, 107. So it's like they're an average defense when he's on the court. When he's off the court, they're allowing only 98.2 points per 100 possessions, which would be like one of the best, if not the best, defensive ratings in the league. So in other words, the difference between him being on the court and off is allowing 8.6 more points per 100 possessions, which is a really terrible number. Some of the worst defenders in the league will have numbers like that. And it really makes no sense, because everything else about Leonard's profile, like his athleticism, he's those enormous hands that he has, his basketball IQ, all of the things that sort of make him have this reputation as being the best individual stopper. And we should also say his individual stats, if you kind of use the player tracking stats for isolations, for instance, or even pick and roll defense, are still among the best in the league. And so it's just like this strange puzzler of why the Spurs are not doing well with him on the court. And there's some theories about it. One is that opponents have actually kind of figured out that he's too good. And so they'll basically have the guy that he's guarding just park him in the corner on offense and then play 4-on-4 and sort of take Kawhi completely out of the play.
But even then, shouldn't the defense still be about the same as it is when he's off the court? Because you're essentially telling me they've taken him off the court.
Right. Yeah, for all intents and purposes, you'd think it would be the same. The other more, I think, an even more compelling kind of complicating factor is that when Kawhi has been on the court, opponents have shot the lights out from three-point land. And when he's been off the court, the Spurs opponents have shot really poorly from three. And you might think, oh, well, this is a function of defense. But it turns out that three-point percentages, especially like by the opponent, are really, really kind of bounce around almost randomly. Not completely so, but with a lot of kind of, you know, unpredictability from season to season, which suggests that some of that split, at least, is probably just due to bad luck. Yeah, some player in the league is going to have a bad run of luck where they're on the court for a bunch of sort of randomly good threes by the opponent, and when they're off the court, their teammates just have a really hot run of shutting down three-point shooting. It just so happens that it's happened to this guy that has this reputation as one of the best defenders, and I think that can go a little, at least some of the way, toward explaining the split. But I think it's still one of the more strange statistical things that we've seen.
Right, because the other side of that coin is that perhaps he had a lot of good luck.
In the past.
Yeah. And that's why it's hard to add in defense from an MVP statistic, because defense to me has always been something that you understand when someone's good at it, if you're absorbing, and also often if you're on the court with them for thousands of minutes, or if you're like a fanatic for a team and you just watch every second of them, because you only understand it if you see them slide into certain positions. And so with Kawhi, to me, the way we understand defense in the NBA is often just reputation. Like, and that's it. And that can be a struggle, because I did this story a few years ago about Billy Knight, a guy who was at UCLA and didn't get drafted because people thought he was slow and a poor defender. And even though he spent like 8 years overseas, like working on his footwork and becoming a good defender, he could not overcome that reputation to get back into the NBA. So when we focus on defense for the MVP, it gets really squishy, because I'm like, how much of this is reputation with like Harden and Kawhi, and how much of this is actually a verifiable fact?
So we've sort of poked holes actually before.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to build up the case for Kawhi, because there should be a case for him as
so,
well.
So yeah, so Neil, you wrote the piece for us at 538.
Right, making the case for, yes. Even though I just made
sorry,
the case.
I let us kind down the cynical end too soon, which is a habit of mine. So your basic thrust was that Kawhi is good at everything.
Yeah.
And not... no one else in the league is good at everything.
Right, yeah. Like, if you accept that the defensive numbers are sort of a one-year aberration, especially, like you said, Kate, given the sample sizes involved and the sort of less reliable nature of defensive stats versus offensive ones, I think it's fair to say that we can still think of Kawhi Leonard as being at least a good defensive player if you know, maybe this casts a little bit of doubt on it this one particular season. But if you do take it as an article of faith that he's a good defender, then sort of based on everything else that he does on the court, so usage rate, true shooting, you know, turnover rate, preventing turnovers, of course, assist rate, steals, blocks, defensive and offensive rebounds, all of the different ways that we can kind of measure a player's performance at various facets of the game, Kawhi Leonard is the only player in the league who is above average at each and every single one of those things. He's the most complete player in the NBA according to that definition. And that was kind of my main thrust. And my secondary thrust, and you hinted at this a little bit, I think earlier, Kate, too, is that the Spurs are a team where, because of where they are in the standings, they need Kawhi Leonard to play at this sort of MVP-like level. And the difference between him not playing at that level and the way that he has actually played, it makes a big difference to their championship odds. Whereas if you took Curry off of the Warriors, for instance, they'd still be one of the elite teams in the league. They would still have like a really high chance of winning. And I think at the opposite end of the spectrum, you take like a Russell Westbrook and OKC, even with him playing at the level he's played, and we'll talk about that later, there's still, you know, the teams that win as many games as they have don't tend to win the championship. So if you look at it in that way, you can kind of say that Kawhi's production comes in this really like sweet spot where it makes a big difference to his team, and that's one way of defining most valuable.
All right. I think we should move on to the next player, but before we do, we have to choose between Kawhi and Curry. Neil, I think your bias is probably well known.
I might be a little biased.
You prefer Kawhi, is that correct?
Correct.
Kate?
This is really tricky because we spent most of the Kawhi part dissing his defense. But I know that I don't believe he got the reputation as like a fantastic defender by accident. So I also pick Kawhi Leonard because of the, to me, where his value lies, and it's something I want to get into later, is the most important metric here. And I think Curry's value, I'll explain later, but I'm picking Kawhi.
Okay. I would have picked Curry, but it doesn't matter because you guys totally...
2-1.
It's why we have three people on this podcast
so
for moments like this.
So one of them can offer an opinion that's too late and doesn't have any bearing. All right. So Kawhi Leonard moves on to the next round. And we should talk about LeBron James. Kawhi Leonard versus LeBron James. LeBron James, he who was once thought to be the unanimous best player in the league, unclear if he still is. This year, though, he's had a really good year, 26.4 points per game, 8.6 rebounds, 8.7 assists. If it weren't for Westbrook and Harden averaging better on those metrics, LeBron would be, I think it is, the only player since, other than Oscar Robertson and Michael Jordan, to average stats that high in those categories. And so this is someone who obviously has a pretty impressive statistical case to make from the baseline, but let's talk a bit more about sort of the more advanced analytics. Neil, do you want to make the case for LeBron, or do you think that there is no case to be made?
Yeah, I'll make the case. Yeah, they're 21st in defense. So that's kind of where the problem lies compared to last year. But yeah, I do think the dichotomy between the team, which seems to be in utter disarray at various times and kind of in a tailspin, versus LeBron's own personal numbers, which are steady and kind of almost a carbon copy of a bunch of other seasons in which he has won the MVP in the past. That makes for, I think, a really interesting kind of question of do you care about all of the things going around a player when they are the leader and the best player of a team, if their own personal house is in order, I guess is one way of saying it. And I'd be curious what you think, Kate.
My concern with LeBron as MVP is that it is MVP of the regular season. And the way I see LeBron playing this regular season, not the numbers, but playing and leading that team, to me, is to set himself up to be MVP of the postseason. So I get concerned because, I guess concern's the wrong word, I question whether he actually is the MVP this year, because in my mind, he's actually devalued what an NBA regular season is about, because it's been so blatantly clear that the Cavs are not playing to be the best regular season team, not even in the Eastern Conference, really.
And we should also say that when LeBron is on the court, the Cavs have played, you know, as good as any team, better than any other team in the Eastern Conference, and sort of at their usual level. I think one of the biggest things is when he's not on the court, they have completely fallen apart. And so, you know, we talked about the plus-minus stats before. This is another case where the big gap between when you're on the court and when you're off the court, in the case of LeBron, it's another 17 point gap in efficiency margin per 100 possessions.
That's the biggest in the league, right?
And so maybe
it's up there with Curry. I mean, Curry are pretty much equivalent. The difference there is that Curry's team is plus 17 when he's on the court and basically zero dead average when he's not on the court. In the case of LeBron, he's like plus 8.5 when he's on the court, and they're minus 8.5 when he's not on the court. And that, you know, I wonder if that bench being so weak should be held against LeBron. It seems unfair to do that. And that also speaks to the fact that, like, if he's playing just the same as he's always played and they're reasonably successful when he's on the court, I'm not sure what else he can necessarily do. Maybe give a pep talk to the second team when he's in the locker room.
Maybe it's unfair, but LeBron has set himself up with the way he discusses his role with the Cavaliers and the way he acts as if he is kind of part-time coach and part-time GM. And so it's not fair when we're discussing the MVP candidate, but how the team plays when he's not on the floor is something I actually start to ascribe to him. because he seems like...
He's injected himself into so much of
and
that
team.
And
that's not fair when you talk about who should be the MVP in a traditional sense. But with LeBron, I do get into, well, what players are on the team? How are they being used? How is this team operating on the day-to-day when he's not just on the court? Because that's what he's been about. And that's what he's talked like he's been about. And so then you also take that onto your shoulders about how people are going to judge, quote unquote, your team that year.
So maybe that means he's the most influential player.
We should change the definition.
Yeah, the MIP.
So it seems to me like when you compare LeBron to Leonard, the case we made for Leonard, eventually made for Leonard, was that he's good at everything. And that the Spurs really needed his talents to take the next step into championship contention. Is that fair to say, Neil?
Mm-hmm.
LeBron feels like he satisfies a lot of that too, right? Like this is somebody who it's very clear that the Cavs would be essentially nothing without him, leaving out the sort of the recruitment aspect of going to play with LeBron, especially for these aging veterans to go, you know, bomb four threes in the finals or whatever they envision themselves to be doing. But and so it strikes me that it's a very similar case to be made for both players.
Right, and LeBron, aside from turnovers, was also better than average at every kind of aspect of playing the game. But I think the big difference there is what we talked about earlier with that like sweet spot, where teams that win as many games as the Cavs are going to end up winning this season just don't win the championship. 51 win teams don't tend to win the NBA championship. In fact, I think that would be the second lowest full season win total of any eventual NBA champion during the regular season. And so, like, what difference does it make according if you ascribe to the theory that it should be about where your team will be, not just in terms of raw, you know, differential of points per 100 possessions, but also where that positions you going into the playoffs. It does seem like they could have had a very low chance of winning the championship without LeBron. It's the old Ralph Kiner.
And also, I don't believe a team has won the NBA title with a worse defense than 19th in the league, the Lakers, in 2001, I believe,
yeah,
with Shaq and Kobe. And now the Cavs are sitting, actually, they were 29th in the month of March. And so half of me knows that it doesn't matter what LeBron and the Cavaliers do in the regular season, because he's reached a point in his career where I think he's sort of accumulating rest and power for the postseason, and we shouldn't look at the regular season as indicative of how the Cavs are going to play. But I hate that that's the case now. Like, I believe a team should be building toward the playoffs. That's what I've always seen. And the Cavaliers seem to be fine with just bumbling through the regular season.
And they might be testing the limits of how much you can kind of cruise through a regular
right.
season and but, then just assume that you can flip some kind of
so,
switch
right.
and magically play better.
But I want to return this to LeBron, since that's what we're talking about.
Sort Kawhi of, wins.
So, Kate, you feel like you know.
I
Kawhi
know.
Wins, and why? Because LeBron, because the Cavs aren't very good?
Yes, because no matter what, the MVP winner should be a player who you believe has put their team in position to go into the playoffs and win the title. The Cavs could do that because who knows what the Cavs and LeBron are going to do, but that's not what has been built throughout this regular season.
Right, and the Cavs are, just one last note on that, is the Cavs are one of the most disappointing teams this season, too, and I feel like it's very difficult, the way that they've played, especially recently, to justify giving LeBron the award. I know that, like, all games count the same, and, you probably shouldn't give extra weight, but just in terms of the way that it feels like a reward given to a team that has kind of, you know, tanked as much as they have down the stretch, especially, and kind of fell short of expectations, seems just weird.
All right. Kawhi moves on to face James Harden.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
James Harden versus Kawhi Leonard. James Harden, 11.2 assists in his first year as the prime point guard for the Rockets under Mike D'Antoni, 8 rebounds, 29.1 points per game, a 52.3% effective field goal percentage. Harden, though, isn't really about like beauty and aesthetics.
You got that right.
And sort of efficient. I mean, this guy is someone who's exploiting the game in all sorts of weird ways. We've written in the past of 538 about how good he is at collecting 3-point fouls. So wrapping his arm basically under someone, under the defender's arm as he takes the three, mm-hmm. In order to get three foul shots and exploit the defense that way. He's got all sorts of weird moves. I think he throws some of the longest passes in the league. Kate.
Am I going to make the statistical
case? You make the
case.
Just make the case for Harden.
Here's why Harden is the MVP. All right. We can go through, and we probably should, his usage rate and the time of possession that he has the ball is actually more than Russell Westbrook. And it's an increase that's like...
A 46% increase from last year.
Okay.
So now he also has the most turnovers in the league.
Right. He also has the most turnovers in the league. And there's the quote-unquote reputation of his defense. I'm going to put Neil on the spot here because I often, when we're discussing MVP, I often don't include defense as much as I should because, as I said before, I think so much of it is reputational based and is actually not steeped in fact. So where are we with James Harden and like points per game that are scored by the Rockets when he's on the floor versus points per game, you know, when he's off the floor?
Yeah, so when he's on the court, the Rockets allow 110 points per 100 possessions, which is pretty bad. And we should say the Rockets as a whole are a below average defense anyway. They rank 17th in the league. When he is off the court, they improve a little bit and they allow about 106 points per 100 possessions. So it's a differential of 4 points per 100 possessions worse with Harden on the floor than off. And when you kind of plug it into the adjustments of the various plus-minus metrics out there, you do find that Harden comes in as one of the worst defensive guards in the league by that metric. And since he does have the reputation and the track record of being bad in that particular area, that's something where it's kind of like you'd be more inclined to trust the number in that case than with something aberrant like showing up that Leonard is bad.
It would show up that Kawhi is one of the worst too, given the numbers you threw at us earlier.
Because it takes into account these plus minus metrics, take into account a player's past performance in the stat, and also kind of diffuse out some of the responsibility. If you're on the court with particular units that are bad, and those units are bad even without you sometimes, even in past seasons, it does kind of like spread it out. So I think Kawhi ends up as being like only kind of a little bit above average this season, according to Real Plus Minus, which in the past he had been like one of the best in the league. For Harden, it's still it's like formerly one of the worst in the league, still one of the worst in the league, but his offense is enough to nearly, you know, make up for it to the point that he ranks as the best player in the league.
Right, because my ultimate explanation for James Harden, I will continue to save, but for now, to me, the value added, not just to James Harden's own numbers, but the value added and distributed to the other players on the Houston Rockets on the offensive end. Like, you're seeing guys play at a level that you've never seen them play at before. Like, Ryan Anderson comes in, and he's a guy who needs to shoot threes and have, like, a glimpse of time. And he ends up, like you said, Chad, because James Harden throws, like, quarterback-level passes, like, the speed at which they go and the distance at which they cover is indefensible. And so you've got other guys on the team who are getting wide open shots in a way they've never had in their career before. So it's James Harden playing in a way that is elevating everyone around him, that's adding even more value to the Houston Rockets on the offensive side of the ball. And we could get into who the Houston Rockets are without him versus with him to be the ultimate explanation of it. But I feel like that should be something we say for like the final round.
You're assuming that Harden makes it to the
final. Well, I'm going to vote for him. So if he doesn't, I'm going to be silent.
So one of the things that I am trying to figure out is sort of the Rockets have a historically great offense. They are much better than they were supposed to be this season. And this gets back into, I think overall, we keep circling this idea of, does the team matter when we try and evaluate MVP? So does it matter how good a team is and how good they were supposed to be? Because one of the tricks about MVP conversations is that narrative is baked in one way or another. Even if you eschew the narrative of, Curry isn't as good as he was the last time that he won MVP, or, LeBron has won it too many times, he doesn't need another one. you still end up to the narratives of the teams and expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rockets were not supposed to be good. Neil spoke about how the Cavs won 51 games.
They were supposed to be good.
They were supposed to be good. They haven't been good. They won 51 games, and now they're very unlikely to win a championship because there's so much signal in the regular season in the NBA, which we've talked about a million times. The Rockets, because of Harden, I would argue, have taken the leap into that upper echelon of teams that can win an NBA championship, that as far as what we see in the regular season. And that is because of Harden, and therefore that, to me, suggests that he is an MVP different than Kawhi, where the Spurs were supposed to be good, even though Neil has shown mm-hmm. that the Spurs needed him to take that leap more than other teams, and LeBron, whoever else. Does that hold water? Because I think Kawhi has a really good case in the sense that the Spurs are better than the Rockets. Kawhi is the most well-rounded player on the Spurs.
In the league,
thank you. And so why wouldn't Kawhi beat Harden? But we all, I think, seem to think that Harden takes it. And so I'm trying to identify and articulate why that is.
Well, I think one of the things is that I'm a big believer for awards like this that maybe it isn't like it's not supposed to go to the player that kind of had the by the numbers strictly the best impact on his team or whatever you want to kind of call it. When there are things that are historic happening, and we'll talk about this with Russell Westbrook in particular, but with Harden, I mean, I think he right now is having the most effective combination of usage and efficiency any player has had in NBA history. Like, his season right now, first of all, there have only been three seasons ever, at least since the merger in the 70s, in which a player used 35% of his team's possessions when he was on the floor and generated at least 115 points per 100 possessions. And though before this year, there was Michael Jordan in 1987, which is one of the best statistical seasons ever, and Dwayne Wade in 2009, which is also in that short list of best seasons by any individual player ever. And Harden has been significantly more efficient than either of those two guys, and he's using significantly more possessions than those two guys in this particular season. To me, this is, especially since he embodies sort of everything good and bad about the modern game of basketball, I would argue probably more good than bad on balance. This is like the quintessential season by a modern NBA player. Like, I don't think you can find...
But you don't get the MVP award for representing your era.
I think you can, though. I mean, because of the symbolic significance of it. I think that's a case
spoken
to be
like
made.
Spoken like a sports historian. You love sports history.
I so love sports like history.
So James Harden wins this round.
Harden is a historic player. And we should also say that according to the things that MVP voters have valued traditionally in the past, which does tend to boil down to counting stats, particularly points, rebounds, and assists per game, maybe some other stats, shooting percentage, whatnot, and team record. According to that kind of cocktail of things that voters have traditionally valued, it's not really even that much of a debate as to whether Harden should be the MVP. He checks off all of the things that traditionally have been valued, this combination of individual stat stuffing and team performance.
So that's all well and good. I'm not sure we're trying to come up with the answer of what the voters, who the voters will pick.
I'm
we're
saying what should. We want.
Yeah. He fits
okay.
the template
okay. so,
of an
James
NBA.
Harden
James
wins.
Harden!
I'm still sort of unclear on the reason, but James Harden beats Kawhi Leonard. And let's move on to our final round. James Harden versus the season-long averaging Russell Westbrook. Way back when on Hot Takedown, we had a conversation about whether or not this kind of thing would be possible. We said the usage, you know, that his body
the
won't
pace.
Hold up, the pace. It's just you can't even imagine a point guard in particular doing this every night over and over and over again.
And
here we
then
are.
At first we were like, there's no way because of the rebounds. But then I forget who it was, whether it was you or maybe it was Kyle who made the great point about how, but he is the designated rebounder on this team.
Mm-hmm.
which means that he gets like 30%.
And my goodness, rebounds. They have ramped that up. Yes. Down the stretch.
Everybody
of the
block
season.
Out, and then Russell comes, gets the rebound.
So
but anyway,
before we do Harden versus Westbrook, let's listen to this take from Stephen A. Smith on First Take on ESPN.
I'm stuck on co-MVP. I'm leaning towards Westbrook in that regard. I get it, but I'm still stuck on MVP because co-MVPs rather because it makes me sick to my stomach at the thought of taking this away from James Harden. It's pretty hard to just take this away from James Harden because Russell Westbrook, in his sensational play and what have you, carrying things on his back the way that he has for the Oklahoma City Thunder. It's so hard for me to just take it away from James Harden. That's why I'm holding on for dear life until the last possible moment to vote on these guys, wait and see or what have you. But I don't blame anybody for feeling otherwise. I'm not trying to take it away from Russell Westbrook. I'm just saying that James Harden to me is an MVP as well.
Let's just do one-on-one. The case for Russell Westbrook is in some ways the easiest case to see. It's the sort of raw stats. I think once you get below the raw stats, it becomes a more difficult case to make, I would argue, in the sense that his efficiency is not good, perhaps because his usage rate is so tremendously high. He's got a 47.7 effective field goal percentage. His win shares are below some of the other folks that we're talking about on this. And then I'll just taint things a little bit before we get going.
That's always
Russell,
a good way
Russell
to preface.
Westbrook, as he exists this season, can't exist on a better team. And I think that should be taken into account. From where I sit, which is that you cannot average the triple-double in the way that he has averaged it, with the usage rate that he's averaged it, if he had anyone else on that team who was not just the designated rebounder, but the designated scorer in some ways, or someone who could take the load off.
So you're kind of saying it's a useless performance because you can't even...
I don't think I'm saying useless in the sense that it's had no purpose. I mean, they're going to make the playoffs. They certainly wouldn't have made the playoffs without Westbrook. My point is, his bona fides, his qualifying... what qualifies him for the MVP and makes him, by many accounts, the leading MVP candidate is that he is on a team in which all of this action goes through him. And he's, granted, converted a lot of that action, but on a team with even a second option.
Yeah.
The numbers drop down, and then you remove a lot of the sort of historic sheen from his candidacy.
I mean... Should we make the case for Russell Westbrook first? Because
yeah.
I actually, on the subway here, like was so passionate about the debate between the two of them, I wrote down notes about why I have my particular MVP candidate. So but we can't jump there
these
yet.
Were anti-Westbrook notes.
You don't know.
I'm assuming.
You don't know.
Okay, I can make the case for Westbrook if we want to. I mean, obviously, the triple-doubles, both in the count and the average... I think, and again, spoken like the sports historian, I think make it pretty clearly the best individual season anyone has ever had in NBA history. Maybe if you went back to Wilt and his 50 points per game average, that's how far back. I mean, the fact that we can bring him back and have him be almost on equal footing with that season, and there's a debate without even taking into account things like pace factor being different, radically different between the 60s and now, is mind-boggling. I wrote a post many years ago where I talked about 1962 and the particulars of that season, not just Wilt, but also Oscar Robertson, and perhaps even more so Oscar Robertson, just thinking about the sheer factors that had to be in place back then that were no longer in place, I thought, in the game now, in order to make those numbers, those insane numbers, happen. And I concluded that too much has changed. The game is so different now than it was then that we would never see something like this happen again. We'd be holding our breath if we thought LeBron could average a triple-double or anyone who came after him. So the fact that a record that seemed like it was one of the most unbreakable records in sports history fell, I think means something, and I think it would be a crime to not recognize that particular performance with the MVP award this year, because it really is, statistically, whether you look at the raw numbers with the triple-doubles or if you look at something like value over replacement player, which is one of the best, certainly the best box score stat we have going back into history to judge players on, this is the best individual performance any player has ever had in an NBA season. Period.
So your vote is for Russell Westbrook.
My vote's for Russell Westbrook on those grounds, that the history of it is important.
Right. And to me, it's the history that you're giving value to of the individual performance, leaving out to some degree the context of the team result within that individual performance. And to me, that's where I lean more heavily on the team result in voting for James Harden. And here's how I think of it, because I think when we talk about value, I think you have to invert it to ask yourself this question. Like, if this was your team, which player's removal from it would be more painful? And to me, the pain of removing, like if I'm a Rockets fan, the pain of removing a player who took our team from out of contention and out of the playoffs to not just in the playoffs, but legitimately a possibility of a title contender is more painful than removing a player from your team who took them from like 13th or 14th in the Western Conference to 6th, 7th in the Western Conference, but not at all a possibility of a title contender.
Because the stakes of that removal are different, you're saying?
Yes, because I think that there should be, in the same way we talked about, like making a good team great is more challenging and painful. It's like as a team moves up the standings based on one player's performance, like moving a team from 14th to 13th should be worth one value point. I'm not giving it a point, but one value. Then when you get from moving them up from 8th to 7th to 6th to 5th to 4th to 3rd, that pull from, to me, from 6th to 3rd is so much heavier than the pull from 13th to 6th, or really from 2nd to 1st in the case of the Spurs, considering the actual weight of 6th to 3rd.
Now,
if that makes sense.
Doesn't that argument, it makes total sense. Doesn't that apply more to Kawhi Leonard, though, than even to Harden?
Well, that's where I don't know. I think we can all,
or at least equally so.
We can all instinctively say, if Harden or Westbrook is removed from the Rockets or the Thunder, both those teams are out of contention. I don't know that I can say, and maybe it's just the pain of history, not the pain, but the blessings of history on the San Antonio Spurs franchise. If you move Kawhi Leonard from the Spurs,
but Kawhi's out. Kawhi's out.
I know, but Neil asked me a specific question about
yeah,
Kawhi.
Yeah, I shouldn't have re-injected a player who is no longer
eligible. I don't
know
where the Spurs land.
But it
land
is kind of
Western
a similar
Conference.
Argument to be made. So if we're making that argument, definitely it more applies to Harden, if those are our two choices, which we've whittled down to, as Chad reminded, more applies to Harden than Westbrook, for sure. But the question is whether or not that, yeah, it really is like, is it better to be a great, legitimately great player, but maybe not the best individual player in the league on a contending team, or the, like, just statistically, the best player in the league, but on a team that has not that much of a chance of winning the championship?
It's even more confusing for this particular year of MVP, because you've got Westbrook with a singular historic season that ultimately wasn't enough to bring a team to matter on the team conversation. Versus,
perhaps, but I'm sorry.
And then they'll go on and win the title, right?
No, I was saying, but perhaps it wasn't enough because the only way
that
he could
have
gotten
exist.
That is that
artificial
it's
variables,
it's right? It's
right.
Yeah.
Bad. And I mean, we should note that when Oscar Robertson averaged his triple double, he finished third in the MVP voting. Wilt Chamberlain that year averaged 50.4 points per game, which I think is on the same level, as we said before, with this Russell Westbrook kind of stat-stuffing season. He finished second in the MVP, and the winner of the MVP was Bill Russell, a guy who averaged fewer than 20 points per game that season, and he won by not just it was not a close race either. It was a pretty big landslide in the MVP voting for Bill Russell that year.
All right. So is that where we're landing? We're landing on Harden, all three of us?
Well, no, because Neil chose Westbrook.
I'm pro Westbrook.
I'm so sorry.
But if you guys are pro Harden, obviously
then you cast the deciding vote.
Yeah, you're the decider,
and
Chad.
It seems like you're leaning towards Harden, but or maybe you want Kawhi Leonard.
I still don't understand why Kawhi Leonard is not in the finals. But that being said, I really just don't understand how – I love being the deciding vote – how one team that is bad has one – player that is transcendent on it, and then that creates the most value.
They're not bad, by the way. We should say, I mean, you said it yourself, they're going to make the playoffs.
But they're not necessarily going to make the playoffs without Westbrook.
That's true. So you mean the difference between...
Of the five players that we're talking about right now, yeah. The Thunder are the worst team, correct?
Right.
Or of the teams of the five players.
Right.
To me, Westbrook's accomplishments are only created by the putridity of the Thunder, until I'm convinced otherwise. All right. James Harden, hot takedowns, 2017.
High five.
MVP. Sorry, Neil.
Yeah, it happens.
Okay, I think we're going to skip Sig Dig this week since we've talked about the NBA so much. We were going to do an NBA Sig Dig about Daryl Morey thinking that there should be a one-game playoff series, but we'll leave that and just wrap it up there.
Okay.
So thanks to Kate Fagan.
MVP.
Thanks to MVP, Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Kate, why are you dragging around that statue everywhere, that trophy?
Why is it so big and gold?
Neil Payne, thanks for chatting about sports.
Hey, thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast's
least valuable players? Oh, that
is
doesn't work.
Jody Avergan. We get production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes as well, iTunes.com/538. Be sure to leave a review and a rating while you're there. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.